turn to our last case for today, 00-0889CR, State v. Davis. Assistant Attorney General Micah Kloss, appearing for the state. Mr. Kloss, good seeing you again.
Thank you, Your Honor. The appeal which was presented to the court involves a rather esoteric statute called the Intrastate Detainer Statute, a statute, I might add, that is probably not used by very many prosecutors or trial judges in the state. It relates directly to a procedure involving the statutory right to a speedy trial that's been afforded to prisoners in state institutions. As an introduction, I'd briefly like to summarize the relevant provisions of that statute as they apply to this case and give a brief history of how this proceeding led to an appeal and eventually a petition for review in this court. The statute involved is section 97111, entitled Prompt Disposition of Intrastate Detainers. And essentially what the statute provides is that if a prosecutor in one of the local counties files a charging document with the warden at one of the state prisons, the inmate is afforded the opportunity to file what's called a request for prompt disposition. This is mailed to the district attorney. And what, in terms of proceedings and remedies, what the statute provides is once that request for prompt disposition is received from the prisoner by the district attorney, the prosecutor has 120 days to bring the case to trial.
What's the point of the statute? Why do you have that? Everybody's
The statute?
Yeah. Why was it enacted? Why do we treat prisoners differently than people on the outside?
Well, there is, unlike the Interstate Detainer Act, there is no legislative finding as to the purpose of the act. The interstate statute says it's to, the legislature finds in that context that outstanding charges may have an adverse effect on the rehabilitation of inmates.
Well, you think that's true then, too, for intrastate?
I think it's a reasonable assumption that the same policy lies behind both
states. Any other purpose?
None that I can think of, and none which the Court of Appeals found.
No, I was thinking that maybe if you have a relatively quick trial, and I don't know if this is possible under the sentencing structure, that you could make any prison sentence served be under the prior offense work for the second offense, so that you don't have somebody facing a trial and a consecutive sentence thereafter. You know what I'm trying to say?
I'm not 100% sure.
What I'm trying to say is the guy's in for 10 years, so you have a trial. You might get another 5 years for this second offense, this new trial.
Correct.
And maybe the fact that he's now serving 10 can act as serving the new 5 that he's going to get. Is that possible under the sentencing?
You mean the second sentence could be made consecutive to...
Or concurrent.
Or concurrent with the sentence he's then serving.
Right, but if you hold him for 10 years and then you're going to give him another 5-year sentence, you have to make it, it's obviously going to be consecutive.
Correct. I guess in response to your question, I know of no legislative history.
No. Okay, well, I can understand that, but one assumes there's a reason for the statute. Right?
Correct.
I'm trying to think of reasons for the statute, because if you know what the reason is, then it might help us decide if this is with or without prejudice, right?
It is possible that it might.
Okay. So we're going to try.
Correct. And I guess in response, I don't have any strong opinion one way or the other. I'm just not aware that there is any legislative history that would suggest that the scenario you outlined was behind the legislature's decision in enacting the statute.
Right.
The Court of Appeals in this case made a general finding, which the state has no dispute, that it was intended to remove the possibility that outstanding charges would adversely affect the rehabilitation of the prisoner, and that is clearly the legislative purpose that is stated in the Interstate Detainer Act.
These charges could have been filed before the person ever went to prison, couldn't they?
They could have. That is correct, Your Honor. In other words, the charges could have been filed or outstanding. It's conceivable that the inmate was at large, was subsequently arrested, convicted, placed in prison, and then at that point, the local prosecutor discovers that the defendant is a prisoner in a state prison and would file the criminal complaint and warrant with the warden there. And then that would, assuming the prisoner filed a request, that would institute the interstate detainer statute. So yes, it's conceivable that those charges could have been outstanding for a substantial period of time before the prisoner is located and charges filed.
In 97111, sub 2,
yes.
Last sentence reads, the district attorney shall bring the case on for trial within 120 days after receipt of the request, subject to 97110. What does that mean?
I believe section 97110 is a statute which provides for a continuance for cause. In other words, it allows this statute, the cross-reference to this statute, in my mind, means that 120 days can be extended if a proper motion for continuance is made and cause is shown.
Mr. Kloss, have other states with similar statutes decided the prejudice without prejudice issue?
I'm not aware of any decision from another state on precisely that issue. In fact, there's very little case law that involves this statute, and this statute has been enacted in such piecemeal and sporadic. It's unlike the interstate detainer statute, where it's pretty uniformly been enacted by all the states, and there's a body of case law to construe it. This statute doesn't have a similar history. And in Wisconsin, there is almost no case law involving this statute. We're almost writing from a blank page in terms of how this statute should be construed. Yes.
At the relative outset, I want to make sure that we're on the same page. Waiver is not an issue in this case. Is that correct?
Well, Your Honor, the state did argue waiver in the Court of Appeals, but this court, in its order granting the petition for review, indicated that the issue to be addressed would be the first issue, and that's the legal issue of whether or not the trial court has authority to dismiss with or without prejudice. So the state is not arguing waiver. The only relevance, and I might mention that in the history of this case, is in terms of the remedy involved here, dismissal with prejudice. Very briefly, a criminal complaint was filed at the state prison charging a conspiracy to distribute marijuana within the state institution on March 16, 1999. The prisoner promptly made a request for prompt disposition that was received by the district attorney on March 23, 1999. Now, if any of the parties involved in this case were aware of the specific provision of the statute, they would have marked on their calendar that 120 days was July 23, 1999. I'm not sure anybody did this. But the record does show that the preliminary hearing was waived. Status conference was scheduled for July 19th, 1999, which would be 4 days before the 120 days. At that point, the trial court entered a series of orders setting a motion hearing and a future status hearing for August to November. On July 28, 1999, the prosecutor and the defense counsel filed a joint motion for another continuance. This would have been 5 days after the 120 days. Finally, on September 9th, the prosecutor and the defense counsel entered a stipulation and recommendation in which the defendant agreed to enter a negotiated plea.
Counsel, you set this out in your brief in part on page 17, and that's what causes me to ask the question, because by going through the conduct of the defendant, it seemed to me that you were really arguing yet the waiver issue, even though we specifically declined to accept the waiver issue. And so it was perplexing to me what relevance there was that there is considerable evidence in the record that the defense acquiesced in the delay of the trial, joined in a request for continuance, and worked from the beginning with the understanding that the goal was a negotiated plea agreement, the very stuff that you seem to be going through now. You're suggesting that it has to do with remedy, but boy, it seems to me that you're trying to argue through the back door the issue of waiver and that they acquiesced in this. So could you respond to that, please?
I would, Your Honor. When I say it's relevant to remedy, the argument I make is that the trial court found that Court of Appeals found the trial court properly exercised discretion by dismissing this case with prejudice, because this is the only way to protect the defendant's right to a speedy trial. And it seems to me that in assessing whether there was a proper exercise of discretion, it's relevant on the speedy trial issue is, did the defendant and his counsel want a speedy trial? If they did not want a speedy trial, and if their conduct and actions on the record indicate they did not want a speedy trial, it seems to me that it's relevant to argue that there would be no prejudice and no occasion for the trial court to dismiss a criminal prosecution with prejudice.
Boy, that's... Okay.
That's my argument.
Okay. Thank you.
Now, I gather this is a statutory case. That is, did the legislature could authorize the court to dismiss with prejudice?
That is correct.
Even though if there is no statute, like in Brownsdorf, this court has said, trial court cannot dismiss with prejudice.
That is correct.
All right? Okay. And I gather that there are, from the legislative history, that the legislature refused to adopt either with or without prejudice.
I think the sequence was that it was with prejudice explicitly, then without prejudice explicitly, and without any explanation, the final draft, which became the statute, just says, like many other statutes, dismissed. That's correct.
Silent on the issue.
Right.
Okay. So what do you do then?
Well, I guess the position of the state initially, before we get to the question of statutory interpretation and legislative intent, the position of the state is that Brownsdorf does address and answer the issue. Now, this court in Brownsdorf, and it reaffirmed it in Kruger, ruled that prior to the attachment of jeopardy, And in the absence of any constitutional violation, a trial court does not have inherent authority to dismiss a criminal prosecution with prejudice. In other words, that's reserved to situations where there are constitutional violations that affect the defendant's right to speedy trial that involve what we court calls substantial rights. Now, Bronsdorf also held that if there is to be authority for a trial court in this circumstance, prior to jeopardy and without a constitutional violation, to dismiss with prejudice, there has to be a statute which authorizes the trial court to do so. And as the state reads Bronsdorf, this court discussed two different types of statutes. One type of statute, and the example that's given in Bronsdorf, is the interstate detainer statute. The statute says the trial court may dismiss with prejudice. It's explicit. The grant of authority is explicit. The second group of statutes is just either dismiss without prejudice or dismissed. That's the two types of statutes that are discussed in Bronsdorf. Now, it seems to me that what the Court of Appeals is saying is there's a third type of statute. And this third type of statute is where the legislature chooses the language dismissed without saying with prejudice or without prejudice. And I'm sure this occurs with some frequency in the Wisconsin statutes. But the Court of Appeals says what that means is the legislature intended to grant authority to the trial courts to dismiss with prejudice or without prejudice as a trial court chose. Presumably based on some feeling of fundamental fairness. And it's the position of the state that this is contrary to Bronsdorf and creates vagueness in the statutes. It seems to me it should be clear. Bronsdorf said a trial court does not have inherent authority to dismiss when, prior to jeopardy, without a constitutional violation. And the reason why is because there are no substantial rights of the criminal defendant involved. There are no constitutional violations involved. The defendant's right to a fair trial is not being violated. I mean, the interest which is involved in this case is the defendant's rehabilitation and the possibility that a delay in trial might adversely affect that rehabilitation. That's the collateral issue that's involved in this case. And it seems to me that if a trial court, if the legislature intended in these circumstances, where there's not a constitutional right involved, where there's no substantial rights of the defendant involved, if in these circumstances the legislature intended that a trial court should be able to, in a sense, invade the discretion of the prosecutor here,
Mr. Claus,
say that it should be dismissed with prejudice, it should be explicit, yes.
I'm having some trouble understanding why the Court of Appeals approach doesn't make sense here, given the legislative history. It's my understanding that the legislative history would indicate the legislature looked at language that would say that the dismissal would forever bar the refiling of the charges. The legislature looked at language that would say, no, the dismissal had to be without prejudice. And they didn't opt for either approach. They took the approach that we'll just say it's to be dismissed. Doesn't that lead to a logical conclusion that they indeed intended to give discretion to the trial judge to do whatever he or she thought was appropriate, either forever bar with prejudice or allow the refiling without prejudice?
I would admit or concede that the legislative history on that part of the legislative history is somewhat obscure. Because I think it would be just as well argued that by rejecting the dismissal without prejudice and choosing dismiss, it seems to me there are, for example, one of the statutes that's discussed in Brownsdorf decision, didn't the court say, and here are examples of dismissal without prejudice, one of the statutes just says dismissed. It seems to me that the legislature is already using the phrase or the word dismissed to mean dismissed without prejudice in statutes.
Well, if that's what they wanted to do, why didn't they adopt that version? Why didn't they just go ahead and say, fine, it's going to be a dismissal without prejudice? They rejected that approach, it appears, just as they rejected the approach of with prejudice.
I think I understand the point you're making, Justice. It just seems to me that in looking at the history of statutes and use of this term, dismissed, that it's used to mean dismissed without prejudice. And one of the examples given in Brownsdorf is exactly that. It cites to a statute that just says dismissed, as in this case. And it means dismissed without prejudice. What the court recognized in Brownsdorf is that there's a common law rule here. There's no inherent authority to dismiss a criminal prosecution. Consider what that means. To dismiss a criminal prosecution with prejudice, where there's no jeopardy, no constitutional violation, unless there is a statute that authorizes. And it seems to me, if you're going to overcome that common law rule, there should be a statute and a clear legislative intent expressed in that statute, which says, yes, in this particular circumstance, even though there's not a constitutional violation, the legislature finds that the trial court should have authority to dismiss with prejudice. And its position of the state is that this court should find, following Brownsdorf, that that should be expressly stated in the statute.
Okay, so your rule is if the statute says dismissed, then it is to be interpreted as dismissed without prejudice.
Correct.
Flat rule, bright line, no problem.
I think that would be, I noticed my yellow light is on you, Your Honor.
We have until your red light's on.
Oh, excuse me, that's right. I haven't been here for a while.
So I know.
I'm confusing my lights.
You were here in Brownsdorf.
I was, and I believe Justice Abrahamson and myself are the only ones still in this courtroom from Brownsdorf.
Justice still strong.
Yeah, but the ghost of Justice Crooks was floating around.
Yeah, since I was a trial judge in Brownsdorf, I certainly am well aware of that case also.
Well, it's an interesting joining here of history.
Judicial history.
Correct.
It doesn't help us, though.
Well, I understand. But I think the bright line rule that I suggest is important. It's important because it make it clear. I actually did a search for the statutes. And
that was my next question. How many did you find?
Well, I have them on a printout here. I found 22 statutes in the criminal code that use just the word dismissed.
Right.
There are very few that
criminal say... Criminal statutes, right, okay.
There are very few that say dismissed with prejudice, or very few that say dismissed without prejudice. And I guess the court will have to make that examination on their own. But my comment would be, I believe if you look at those, you'll see from the context that, in fact, the legislature did mean dismissed without prejudice when it used the word dismissed. And it seems to me that's appropriate. If this was a situation where the interest involved was the defendant's right to a fair trial or some other substantial right of the defendant, then the court's going to have authority to dismiss with prejudice under the constitutional rules. But here we have a case that's a pretrial situation where the only interest involved is the rehabilitation and the possibility of an adverse effect in that rehabilitation for the prisoner. It seems to me in that situation you should not overcome and override the common law rule forbidding dismissal with prejudice unless there is a statute and a clear legislative declaration that in this case trial court has authority to dismiss with prejudice.
Counsel, why is the 120-day rule onerous to the state if you have in sub 4 of 97110 the possibility to get a continuance? It's not like this is, you're tied to this and come heaven or high water.
I agree 100% with Your Honor. It's not an onerous burden, and there is a provision there where continuance can be. But I'm afraid what happened here is, like I mentioned before, there's been a lot of litigation over this statute in the last year or two. But before that, it was kind of out there silent. Attorneys, trial judges, and I think even prisoners were not even aware it existed. So I think what happened in this case was simple inadvertence. We had the prosecutor and the defense attorney going through, and what they were negotiating was a plea agreement. And they went through where they waived the preliminary hearing, and they had status conferences, and they entered into motions, joint motions to continue the case and so forth. Unaware that there was a statutory time limit for trial that was running, because the stipulation and plea to enter the negotiated plea here was in September of 1999. And it's not until January of 2000 that the motion to dismiss is raised, 6 months later after the time limit had expired. So I just think it was inadvertence. And the question then is remedy. For the state and the public and the security of the prison, we compromise because there was a statutory violation.
Kind of a good faith exception to the 120-day rule. They didn't mean it.
In a manner of speaking. And like many, as I tried to point out earlier in my argument, when we have violations of statutes or violations of constitutional rights, we always speak of remedies. And I don't think you can rationally speak of what is the appropriate remedy unless you know what the interest involved is. I guess I've made this point many times. What the interest here is, as it helps to determine and should determine what the appropriate remedy is. And I think in this case it was simply a matter of inadvertence by the prosecutor and the trial court with respect to this statute. And now I do see my red light is on. Thanks very much.
Thank you, Mr. Kloss. Ms. Smith, representing the defendant, Christopher Lee Davis.
Thank you. I apologize in advance for my voice. I've done the best I can to keep it functioning. May it please the court, before I go into the prepared remarks, I'd like to respond briefly to a couple of the first questions that were asked. And first is, you asked questions about the purpose of the statute. While there were no legislative findings as to the purpose of the statute, the documents that were provided by the state in their argument show that there were legislative purposes advanced by the Department of Corrections when they proposed this statute. And those included the adverse effects on defendants in planning programming and in getting defendants to cooperate with programming when they have the uncertainty of additional and possibly consecutive sentences dangling out there that aren't resolved, and the security classification problems involved in having detainers outstanding. Department of Corrections has administrative regulations that govern the security classification of inmates, and the department can only move individuals within the prison system according to those regulations. And you can't put somebody in minimum security if they have an outstanding detainer. It limits Department of Corrections moving. In addition,
counsel, those interests are superior to the constitutional right to a speedy trial.
No, they're not superior to the constitutional right to a speedy trial, but they play into that same thing. The department has an interest in having those speedily resolved, just as does the individual whose rights are at issue.
Well, the reason I ask the question is because even when evaluating the remedy for a constitutional violation, we look to prejudice to the defendant in terms of the length of the delay, the reason for the delay, what are the other Barker versus Wingo factors, the defendant's assertion of the right or acquiescence in a delay, as in this case, and any other areas of prejudice to the defendant. So if we disallow a dismissal remedy for a constitutional violation where there is no real prejudice to the defendant, why would we do so in a statutory violation? Does that make any sense in the hierarchy of values?
Well, in the first place, because there are adverse effects on the defendant if they aren't resolved.
But you've just conceded that those are not superior to a constitutional violation. So
they're not superior to, but they're parallel. They're both running to the defendant's benefit.
Right, but it seems to me that if we buy the argument that a dismissal with prejudice is a remedy that would lie for a statutory violation, we put the statutory right...
I can't hear you.
If we adopt the argument of the Court of Appeals opinion that dismissal with prejudice is an appropriate remedy for a violation of the statutory right to a trial within 120 days on an intrastate detainer, it seems like we elevate that statutory right above the constitutional right, because even in a violation of the constitutional speedy trial right, we require an evaluation of all of those layers and levels of potential prejudice before allowing that. Right?
We are not advocating that it's a blanket, always dismissal with prejudice. The court can factor into its decision those other things.
But the Court of Appeals opinion in this case and the Circuit Court's ruling in this case said, if we don't dismiss with prejudice, this rule has no teeth. So as I read the Court of Appeals opinion, it's tantamount to a per se dismissal with prejudice, because there will, according to the rationale of the Court of Appeals opinion, otherwise not be any teeth in the rule, in the statute. I mean, wasn't that the crux of the Circuit Court's ruling?
That's the crux of the Circuit Court's ruling, in part because the state did not advocate any reasons not to do that at the trial level. Because there is discretion given to the trial court, when the 120-day rule is violated, the district attorney can't come into court and say, Judge, in this particular case, the values are different. And the values are different in this case because. And the court can weigh them. It isn't a blanket rule. What they're saying is, here, in this case, there were no other values advocated. And the common sense general feeling would be, absent some other considerations, the same rules that say we should set up the statute and the 120-day rule in the first place also govern why we ought to put a tooth in it.
Did the trial court engage in a weighing and balancing of the length of the delay, the reasons for the delay, the defendant's acquiescence in the delay, any prejudice to the defendant's prison programming that accounted for that was
affected
by the delay?
There was a discussion of the weighing of potential penalties, but they were couched in different phrases by the state. The district attorney says, if you want to punish us, Judge, punish us by making us do it twice, not by dismissing. She never advocated anything else. She took it as a personal punishment for the state, rather than saying, Judge, there's no harm here.
Okay, so I take it to mean by your answer that the answer to my question is no. The trial court did not engage in that kind of weighing and balancing, but it was because that was not advocated by the DA.
Well, it weighed and balanced other factors, only those brought up in that particular case. And that brings us into stuff.
Go back in the discussion for just a minute. One, you read the Court of Appeals decision to say dismissed means dismissed with or without prejudice, and the trial court has discretion to do either.
Yes.
And you're supporting that?
Yes.
Now to return to Justice Sykes. Then, and this is at page 110 of your appendix. The Court of Appeals was then left with having to determine whether the discretion had been appropriately exercised, right?
Right.
And that's what Justice Sykes is asking you about. And
on paragraph 18, the circuit court says, I also find as a matter of law that without dismissal, without prejudice, this court's view would leave absolutely no teeth. So that looks like it's automatic in every case. And then it goes on in that vein. Okay.
Well, Your Honor, if you look at the positions that were advocated in the Court of Appeals, we were advocating for bright line always with prejudice rule. The state was advocating for a bright line always without prejudice rule. And the court did what I think it should have done. It looked at the legislative history and it looked at the internal structure of the statute and decided that a midpoint is appropriate. And absent any other countervailing issues, then you got to put some teeth in it.
But the problem is, once you get into exercise of discretion, you have to see if it was exercised. Then in paragraph 19, the circuit court said, because of my knowledge, you're sitting in this court with inmates on a regular basis, the number of the institutions we have, and because these charges pending do affect their security classification, why would somebody put this in the statute to get this done? Now, there are a lot of dots in there, and that's what I'm going to ask you to fill in, and I'll check the record. I'm assuming you are all interested in rehabilitation. We can't rehabilitate inmates by keeping them in security classification simply because their charge is pending. So it seems as if he exercises discretion based on that, but not some of the factors, and maybe he doesn't have to use the factors that Justice cites. What we have to do is see if he's erroneously exercises discretion, assuming we agree with the exercise, and I think that's the point of the question.
Well, the point, right, that's part of the point that I was trying to get you to address. He seems to be speaking, the circuit court judge and the Court of Appeals, by incorporating by reference those portions of the circuit court judge's ruling. He's speaking in generalities rather than any specific weighing and balancing of the factors that are articulated in Barker versus Wingo for determining whether in a specific case a specific defendant has suffered prejudice. And if that's how it's going to be decided, we have effectively elevated the statutory right above the constitutional right, and is that proper in our hierarchy of values?
Except I don't think that anywhere it says that you have to evaluate those particular, the Barker versus
Wingo. I agree, it doesn't say that, but that's what we're all about here. Right. And what I'm asking you is that, you know, where we have a certain procedure and, you know, case law for evaluating constitutional violations, which you have conceded are worse legally than a statutory violation, and you're not going to require the same sort of individualized analysis of prejudice.
Well,
to determine a violation or the remedy for a violation of the statute, that seems to me wrong.
Well, in this particular case, and this is where we get into the whole business of going back to Bronsdorf. The state cites Bronsdorf as saying you can't interpret the statute this way. But Bronsdorf is dealing both with inherent powers, not at all with statutory authority, and they don't purport to make any findings about the statutory interpretation. They simply note other statutes.
Well, I think
so we get to there. But the state wants to read Bronsdorf as a blanket rule without realizing that what the legislature did when they enacted this particular statute was they inherently made a finding that this particular group of individuals needs additional protection. And when the trial court, talked about rehabilitation and about security classifications, he was bringing in his own knowledge to acknowledge that those are reasons behind the statute and the 120-day rule.
Let me just see if we can get at it differently. Justice Sykes is saying to you, well, I will say to you, if this were a constitutional violation of speedy trial, the trial court would have to go through hoops A, B, C, D, E.
Right.
We now have a violation of what looks like a statutory speedy trial. Therefore, let us agree with you. It is a discretionary matter under the statute, even though it may not be discretionary under the Constitution. Should the Circuit Court go through the same hoops, A, B, C, D, E? Should you engraft the constitutional speedy trial doctrines onto the statute?
I would look at it the other way. I would say that there is an assumption or even a presumption that if you haven't requested a continuance under the provisions of the speedy trial statute, which are engrafted into the felony time limits here, by the terms of the statute, sub in sub two. If you didn't, if the state didn't do that, and the state missed the deadline, then the state had better justify to the court reasons not to dismiss with prejudice.
I thought they stipulated to a continuance.
No. That's a misreading of the statutes, or of the case law here. What happens is, and you have to understand the function here, the prison officials get notice of the outstanding charges. They tell the defendant, not his counsel. And the defendant's got to tell the director of the prison to send the statutory certified mail notice. And if you don't jump through all those hoop rights, you know, hoops, right, you don't get the statute at all. That's what Adams tells us. But if you do that, the DA is the only one who's got notice that this is the 120-day limit. And that's why it's got to go by certified mail.
I think it's...
Counsel, I understand the argument. Under your position, if the state cannot bring the case to trial in time, then it can move for continuance under the statutory speedy right provision of 971.10. Unlike the statutory analysis, which discusses prejudice, sets forth certain factors that the court must consider in what is tantamount to a good cause extension requirement. And so for the statutory right under 971.11, it, as your term is, engrafts, makes reference to, incorporates the provisions of 971.10, specifically 971.10 sub 3, yes, which for the statutory analysis sets forth the factors separate and distinct from the constitutional violation. Is that your argument?
Yes. And what happened here was that the defendant personally invoked 971.11. Then he got an attorney, and they proceeded to litigate it. Only after the 120-day time limit had already expired was there any request to continue anything. So by then it was too late. You can continue at that point to no end, but it's somewhere along the line the defendant pointed out to his counsel. And remember, he's working from the handicap of being in the prison system. Let's just attorney know that too much time has passed to do something, and they filed the motion to dismiss. There was no plea, and there was no request for a continuance by the state or by the defense until after the statute had expired.
Was the defendant in court when the original scheduling conference was held and the trial date was set, which, as I understand it, was set after the 120 days?
And I don't think we'll know at all because there was no record of that scheduling conference kept. And that's the other problem here. If what we're talking is a waiver analysis, it is the state that has waived and has waived all along here the right to even bring that argument. One, because they do not produce a record that shows that the defendant agreed or defense counsel agreed to the descheduling order.
That there isn't any, there was no on-the-record proceeding on the trial date?
No, there was none. Just this written order comes out. And secondly, the
the state never argued waiver to the trial court and therefore never gave the defense attorney any chance to rebut it. If I came in here with an argument for the first time on appeal, you'd give me short shrift and rightly so. But it should go both ways.
Would you concede that Brownsdorf establishes that the default rule in common law is no inherent authority in the circuit court to dismiss with prejudice?
Brownsdorf's explicit holding is there is no inherent authority.
Right, so that's the default rule in common law, right?
I don't even know if you'd call it common law, because what Brownsdorf did is they said there's been a long-standing history of prosecutors dismissing cases. Is there a common law, a statutory basis? No, there wasn't. Is there a common law one? Well, we looked at three cases and we decided that's not a common law decision. Now let's look if there's an inherent authority. There was no authority at all for what Judge Crooks, with right fervor, did.
So it's not a statutory rule. It's a common law rule that there is no inherent authority in the trial court to dismiss with prejudice.
Absolutely. But
that's the common law rule.
That's a common law rule regarding inherent authority.
I understand, but let me get to the next question. Isn't it the rule that in order to effectively abrogate the common law, the statute, and the legislature is entitled to abrogate the common law, but if it does so, the statute must do so explicitly, not implicitly, but explicitly. And this statute does not explicitly overrule or abrogate that common law rule. It is simply silent as to whether or not the dismissal is with or without prejudice, and so that's ineffective to abrogate the common law rule.
It's apples and oranges.
Why?
Because inherent authority is authority that does not derive from a statute. This is
not for the common law.
Right.
Right.
And this is an explicit grant of authority to dismiss a case from the legislature to the court for a specific purpose to advance specific goals.
Right, and as I understand the state's argument, it's that in order to do that, in other words, in order to effectively overrule the common law default rule, which is no dismissal with prejudice, the statute has to say so explicitly. If it's silent, that's not good enough. If it's silent, that means without prejudice.
Except that's a logic that doesn't flow from Brownsdorf. What they're doing is taking Brownsdorf, which says there is no statute on this issue. There is no common law on this issue. Is there inherent authority on this issue? That is general right to dismiss with prejudice to control our calendar. No, there is not. That doesn't govern the question of whether. Explicitly grants you authority to dismiss whether there's, quote, a default, whether it's with or without prejudice. You have to ascertain the intent of the statute when the statute is ambiguous. In this case, the statute specifically tells the legislature, tells the trial court, you have the authority to dismiss when the 120-day rule is up.
No, it doesn't say you have to, it says you shall.
You shall dismiss.
Right.
And it doesn't say with prejudice, and it doesn't say without prejudice. So people of ordinary understanding could read it either way. So then you have to go back and discern what was the intent of the legislature. And if you look at the documents we have on legislative intent, first they said it should always be with prejudice. Milwaukee County had a fit, and they said it should always be without prejudice. Then Sanger Powers, who was the director of Department of Corrections at the time, said, I've seen the Milwaukee addition. I don't like it. I am suggesting that you say barred forever unless dismissed without prejudice. Well, that's a wordier version of exactly what the legislature did.
Right, but we don't interpret statutes based on what Sanger Powers says. We interpret statutes based on what they say and based on the rules of construction, and one of the rules of construction is that in order to effectively abrogate a common law rule, and I think it must be conceded that the common law rule is no dismissal with prejudice, the statute must do so explicitly rather than implicitly, and the Court of Appeals decision in this case is an implicit finding that it can go either way, and the discretion is vested in the trial court. That's an overruling of the common law, which says no discretion.
Where I disagree with you is that there's a common law rule of no discretion.
That's what Braunsdorf says.
And that's what I disagree with you on. Because Braunsdorf says there is no inherent authority. When the legislature doesn't say anything about giving you any power to dismiss, then the court can't take it on itself as part of its administration of its general need to administer its court. That's the inherent authority rule. They didn't discuss at all what happens when the legislature in fact says you do in fact have the power to dismiss here. How you determine when it should be with prejudice and how you should determine when it's not with prejudice. And if you go further, the state says that if you, and they accept the rule of construction that says you should read the statute so that nothing is superfluous. And they compare that to the Interstate Act and say that says with prejudice, therefore this one's got to mean without. And that's apples and oranges as well, because that statute was not created by the Wisconsin legislature. We adopted an Interstate Act. We were not after this one. After the Intrastate Act was originally adopted, we adopted the Interstate, the Uniform Act, and the Uniform Act says with prejudice.
But seems
and the only reason to say with prejudice.
Can I ask a factual question? When Mr. Davis asked for a prompt disposition, did he specifically cite 971.11?
It has been conceded that he followed the required statutory procedure and the required forms were sent. There are regular DOC forms you fill out that go through. He knew what he was doing, and he knew he was intending to invoke
the statute. Did the form refer to the statute? I mean, that would respond to the question.
I believe it does. I have to look to be sure. It doesn't say the statute. It says, I request that a prompt disposition of this case be sent to the appropriate authority on my behalf.
Counsel, the very top right of the form, it makes reference to 971.11.
Yes. That's the form. It's page 118 of the state's appendix.
It's Department of Corrections form.
Right.
It seems to me, counsel, that might argue, but maybe I'm wrong, just wrong on this, that doesn't say anywhere that a statute to overturn the common law has to be explicit.
No. I don't think it says. The rule of statutory construction is to discern the intent of the legislature.
It seems to me that the legislature is the public policy maker, and that you have to discern its intent, and that if it might refer to the common law in its legislative history, or it might not. But it also strikes me that the if you follow what the circuit court did here, that it did not, that it could always say that discretion has to be exercised to dismiss with prejudice, because the rehabilitative purpose is always somewhat handicapped. So it strikes me that your position might be, and maybe it is your alternative position, I forgot to look in your brief, that you agree with the Court of Appeals, and should the court say that the exercise was erroneous, it has to go back for an exercise. But you don't. You just want to affirm, right?
That's correct. It appears to me that absent any argument by the state as to a reason why the general rule implied by the statute, that is that it should be dismissed, doesn't have teeth, We've effectively written the statute out of existence altogether. There was a clear purpose for the statute. The purpose remains valid today. The defendant did what he could to advance it by filling out the appropriate form and sending it through.
Could I ask you one other question? Do you have the statute in front of you?
Yes.
97111?
Yes.
Wasn't the original purpose of the hearing in January to take a plea? Accept a plea?
I don't remember what the original scheduling of that date was, but in fact they never did, because prior to that date, the defendant filed his motion to dismiss under 97111.
Well, that motion was filed in March, but there was a lot of subsequent activity, and I think there was a hearing scheduled in January to take a plea, or at least that was the indication of some preliminary activity. Now, if that's those are the facts, could you discuss 97111, subsection 4? Doesn't that take you out of the 120 days?
No, I don't think it does, because even though they may have scheduled it, again, that was defense counsel, not the defendant. And I don't think that's the right sequence, to tell you the truth. He had it down.
We should separate the actions of counsel from the actions of the defendant?
I think you can't ever assume that because a defendant says today that I want to plead, that up and until he does, he doesn't have the right to, until he actually enters that plea, he continues to have the right to change his mind and to have a trial. There has never been law in Wisconsin that holds a defendant to the statement, yes, I think I'll accept your offer. And we can't do that. At least now without some authority, some place to do it.
Counsel, an interpretation of the Court of Appeals opinion could be that the trial court has discretion. But, as the circuit court stated in this case, unless you dismiss with prejudice, there is no teeth in the statute. Ergo, the Court of Appeals opinion and the Circuit Court's opinion, I think, can be interpreted as paying lip service to the idea that the court has discretion, but by saying there's no teeth and there's no real remedy unless you dismiss, are essentially establishing a bright line rule of dismissal, although parroting the words that there's discretion. How do you respond to that?
I don't think it's a bright line rule. I think it's a presumption. The statute was enacted to effectuate a particular purpose, that is to give incarcerated defendants a speedier trial than other people get. If the state, having an opportunity to ask for continuance, doesn't and blows the deadline, then we presume that the deadline has a meaning, and that meaning is it's dismissed with prejudice, unless the state can come up and convince the court that there's a reason why in this case it would be inappropriate to do so.
Okay, but now you're judicially rewriting the statute to contain not only the words with or without prejudice in the discretion of the judge, but there shall be a presumption of with prejudice. Isn't that judicially rewriting the statute? The statute just says the case shall be dismissed. It doesn't say with or without prejudice, but now we've read in with or without prejudice in the discretion of the trial judge, and the trial judge shall presume with prejudice is the order of the day unless that presumption is overcome.
The state seeks to add the words with prejudice, without prejudice in all cases. What I'm simply saying is there has to be a meaning somewhere to the statute. And if the statute in 120 days means anything, you've got to at least start from the premise it means something. I don't know whether you call it a, if you call it a presumption, but that was with the practice. We're asking you to interpret the statute and to tell us how to look at it. It appears to me that unless you are going to read out the time limits altogether and read in the words with prejudice, you have given the statute no meaning whatsoever. And in particular, you also read out of it at that time the last sentence or two of sub 7, which specifies conditions under which the court can have a trial after the 120 days. And you read out the reference to 970.10 and the continuances that you can grant thereunder. So either you're going to read all of that out or you're going to figure some way to read it that gives weight to everything the legislature put in there. I think that's what you need to do. I think the Court of Appeals was right, and I know that's a dangerous thing to say.
Thank you, counsel. Mr. Gloss has 5 minutes to rebuttal.
Thank you, Your Honor. The point's been made with respect to the provisions in the Interstate Detainer Act and the Intrastate Detainer Act. And it seems to me that when the legislature intended to authorize trial courts to dismiss a case with prejudice, they chose that language and included it in the statute. In the Interstate Detainer Act, there is specific provision for dismissal with prejudice. If in the Intrastate Act, dismissal means dismissal with prejudice, it seems to me the language in the Interstate Detainer Act is superfluous. And I would submit that the Interstate Detainer Act is just not a model statute. When the Wisconsin legislature enacted the Interstate Detainer Statute, that is as much the legislation of the Wisconsin legislature as any other statute in the Wisconsin Code.
Boss?
Yes?
Are you finished with that point?
I am.
Forgive me if you've asked or responded to this already, and it just floated past me. But the Court of Appeals opinion makes reference to its concern that if the state were to prevail in its argument, that would have the effect of simply allowing the defendant to, or allowing the state to bring another, you know, bring one more prosecution, then after another 120 days, bring another one, ad infinitum, and the defendant would have no recourse. And so the whole thrust of the statute could be circumvented by the state.
Okay.
How do you answer that?
My response is twofold. Number one, there is an incentive for prosecutors to comply with the statute, and that is, if the case is dismissed, they're going to have to start all over.
Oh, yeah.
New filing, new preliminary examination. I think that is a real incentive to comply with the statute. But more directly, to respond to your issue about refilings, and that is, the defendant has a constitutional protection in terms of guaranteeing his right to a speedy trial. For example, what happened in this case, of course, is there was just one violation that occurred. There never was a refiling. But let us assume that 4 or 5 months go by, there's a violation of the statute. Sometime later, the prosecutor again refiles, allows 4 more months to go by. So now we're up to 9 or 10 months that have elapsed, with the prosecutor deliberately delaying the process. If a prosecutor called me up and asked me for advice, I would say, if you Mr. Prosecutor, violated the statute a second time, you're jeopardizing your prosecution, not under the statute, but under the Constitution. Because we have got a situation where 9, 10, perhaps more months have expired, and the reason for the delay is the prosecutor and not the defendant, and the prosecutor is deliberately delaying the trial. It seems to me that the constitutional analysis that Justice Sykes mentioned, the Barker versus Wingo, is going to be applied. And I can't say, each case depends on its own facts. But my opinion and my advice to the prosecutor is if you did it twice under these circumstances, you're at least jeopardizing your criminal prosecution. Not because there's a statutory violation, because a trial court may find a constitutional violation. And I cannot imagine a prosecutor doing it three times.
I have a question
and getting away with it.
I have a question about 971.10, yes. The continuance statute, which is incorporated by reference in this statute, 971.11. Isn't there language either in the statute or in the case law interpreting the statute that precludes considerations of calendar congestion as a basis for the granting of a continuance? And you think that's a reason why counties like Milwaukee County, from which I come, had a fit when there was a proposal to make this dismissal explicitly with prejudice when the statute was proposed?
I can't answer that question directly. There might be...
Sub C, I think.
Is there sub C? Okay,
yeah,
I don't
three,
have the statute.
971.10
in front of me. I guess the position of the state is... I think it would be unfortunate if we started taking these statutes one by one where dismissed was used and try and decide whether or not it should be dismissed with prejudice somehow in the discretion of the trial court based on fairness and not a constitutional violation. Thank you very much.
Thank you, Mr. Glass. Thank you, Mr. Smith. That ends the hearing on 00-0889 CR State v. Davis. We are recessed until...